This morning, Assistant U.S. Attorney Murphy, a huge man in a blue suit, wearing a British guardsman's mustache, looking sort of like a younger and bigger edition of Charles Lawton, was questioning Chambers, the government's star witness. At times, Chambers appeared almost bored with the whole proceedings. He slouched to the right in his chair, looked up at the ceiling to meditate, heaved a sort of weary sigh before answering, closed his eyes when counsel approached the bench for a conference. His voice was low, with a tendency to swallow the ends of sentences. The judge and Lloyd Stryker, the defense counsel, kept asking Chambers to speak up without noticeable effect. Murphy drew from Chambers the story of the books he had translated from French and German, the various jobs he had held, where and how he first met Alger Hiss. Chambers told his story of how he came to New York and took Hiss to Brooklyn, where, on the mezzanine of a movie house, he introduced him to Colonel Bykoff, a Russian agent. Next part. Returned to have dinner at the Port Arthur restaurant in Chinatown, where Bykoff, speaking German with Chambers translating, asked Hiss if he would procure secret documents from the State Department, and, according to Chambers, Hiss agreed to do it. Chambers told how, when he wanted a new car, Hiss gave or loaned him $400. He told of seeing Mr. and Mrs. Hiss shortly before Christmas of 1938, when he said he pled with them to break from the Communist Party, and they refused. Chambers was handed 47 documents and two rolls of film. He was asked whether he had received these documents from the hands of Alger Hiss. He went through them, taking an average of 4 seconds to a document, and said that that was true. Those three soft voices, Judge Kaufman, Murphy, and Chambers, continued to unravel this fantastic tale. When Murphy had finished questioning Chambers, Stryker, a short, square-shouldered man with white hair cropped short, took over the cross-examination. He barked at Chambers, "Do you know the meaning of an oath?" Chambers said yes. Stryker hitched up his trousers, tightened his belt, and went to work on Whitaker Chambers. He showed him an affidavit that he said Chambers had signed when he worked for the government in the WPA project, in which Chambers swore to defend and uphold this government. "Is that signature yours?" snapped Stryker. "Yes," said Chambers. "Then you lied when you signed it," said Stryker. Again, in that casual, almost bored voice, Chambers said, "Certainly." Stryker wanted to know whether Chambers had ever used the name Crossley. Chambers said he wasn't sure, but he might have. The harder Stryker hammered at him, the more casual and relaxed he seemed to become. And during this whole time, Mr. and Mrs. Hiss sat there as though they were watching a mildly interesting experiment, the outcome of which didn't concern them the least bit one way. There was something unreal about the whole scene. The impression of a flawless performance by everyone concerned, but at the same time, there was a sense that there are forces and factors involved in this conflict that have not yet been placed upon the record. Whatever the outcome of this trial, 12 of those people sitting in the jury box will have to decide which of these two men is telling the truth. And as I watched them file out of that jury box, they were just average-looking Americans. I couldn't help thinking that there, so help me, in the whole system of trial by jury, resides our greatest defense against tyranny.